The New Testament reading this morning is from Acts 2, verses 1 to 13. When the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place. And suddenly from heaven there came a sound like the rush of a violent wind, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting. Divided tongues as of fire appeared among them, and a tongue rested on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other languages as the Spirit gave them ability. Now there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven living in Jerusalem, and at this sound the crowd gathered and was bewildered because each one of them heard them speaking in the native language of each. Amazed and astonished, they asked, "Are not all these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we hear, each of us, in our own native language? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, in our own languages we hear them speaking about God's deeds of power." All were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" But others sneered and said, "They're filled with new wine." I'm naturally a pretty quiet person. I shop for a new clock by virtue of how softly it ticks. Silent is best. I avoid crowds whenever possible. Just too much noise and too many things going on all at once. But despite how inconsistent it sounds after saying all that, I love the noisy cacophony of the Pentecost story. Can you imagine what it must have been like? An awesome, violent wind, like a hurricane maybe, attracts a huge crowd, and you hear those empowered by the Holy Spirit speaking in a large variety of foreign languages. Imagine catching the sounds of your own native tongue somewhere in the crowd, and after a search, finding the speaker. The speaker himself is wondering what he's saying. Since the two of you could probably communicate in the common tongue of Aramaic or Greek, you tell him what he's saying. What a wonder for you both. I've always been interested in language, in what it can and cannot do, of what it would be like to be without it, of what it's like to be illiterate, of how a beautiful painting or a piece of music or bird song at sunrise speak to me in a wordless language. Working on a French minor in college, I lived on the floor of a large dorm where we were supposed to speak only French. We did speak French in the dining room, but often cheated in the privacy of our rooms. When I was assigned a native Parisian roommate who insisted on following the rules, I spent the whole quarter in the library so I wouldn't have to talk to her in my pitiful French. I look back now and see it as the wasted opportunity it was. Traveling abroad gave me my first experience in being illiterate. It was so humbling. I learned the hard way that peligro in Spanish means danger, and that senso unico in Italian means one way. In Bulgaria, they use this Russian Cyrillic alphabet, which has 21 consonants and 10 vowels, only 6 of which are the same as English. When I went for a walk there in the capital of Sofia, I walked in a straight line on the same street and back. I couldn't read the street signs reliably enough to reassure myself I'd be able to find my hotel any other way. Besides, you can use gestures to communicate non-verbally, right? I discovered that Bulgaria is one of only 2 countries in the world where nodding your head up and down means no, and shaking your head left to right means yes. I went into a tiny family-owned store and mimed my need for a Band-Aid for an injured finger. They nodded sympathetically at me while I waited for them to hand me the Band-Aids from behind the counter until I realized they were essentially saying, "No, we have no bandages." It didn't help when I learned that the younger generation there was learning that the rest of the world operates differently, so they were changing. Nodding and shaking heads were useless language there. But you don't have to travel abroad to be exposed to other languages. Have you bought anything lately that came with instructions? Our new DVD player last year came with a 50-page instruction booklet. I was relieved when I realized that only 7 pages were in English. It makes me think of a 22-year-old friend of mine, born in India but raised here, who recently married a man born and raised in Mexico. Mostly she speaks English to him, and he speaks Spanish to her. One day I was helping her make an airplane reservation for her and her new niece and nephew. She was on the phone to her husband explaining that she needed official documents with the exact names of the niece and nephew so there would be no identification trouble. He did not understand the problem. Occasionally she'd throw in a word or two of Spanish, hoping to get the concept across, but she didn't know the words for official document or birth certificate, and we had to abandon the effort when the frustration level got too high. I don't envy the two of them as a married couple. When I think of how Jeff and I don't always seem to be speaking the same language, even when we're both speaking English, I think they have their work cut out for them. In fact, lately, Jeff and I have been speaking frog. It started the other day when I did something less than bright, and Jeff felt compelled to observe, "You're not the smartest frog on the lily pad, you know." I narrowed my eyes and gave him my best withering look, which is a silent language all its own. And he replied, Rabbit, did I say something out loud? And the frogs make me think of all the other languages that nature speaks. Chief Dan George of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation in North Vancouver, British Columbia, expresses it beautifully. The beauty of the trees, the softness of the air, the fragrance of the grass speaks to me. The summit of the mountain, the thunder of the sky, the rhythm of the sea speaks to me. The faintness of the stars, the freshness of the morning dewdrop on the flower speaks to me. The strength of fire, the taste of salmon, the trail of the sun, and the life that never goes away, they speak to me, and my heart soars. In her poem, The Failure of Language, Jacqueline Berger, a creative writing professor at a California university, asks her students by way of introduction on the first day of the term whether they believe that language is our best tool, or if language fails to express what we know and feel. When bent to its work in the hands of a poet, for instance, the tool is exquisite. Berger writes, "I think about the poet helping his wife to die, calling his heart helpless as crushed birds, and the soles of her feet, the voices of children calling in the lemon grove. To me, that man's ache becomes palpable mainly through the beauty of the language." But almost all of Berger's students side with language as failing. She wonders, is it because they're young, still finding it hard to say what they mean? Or are they romantics holding music and art, the body, anything wordless as the best way in? Berger continues writing about visiting a friend in the hospital. "Sitting next to my friend in her hospital bed, she tells me she's not going to make it, doesn't think she wants to, all year running from the deep she's now drowning in. I change the flowers in the vase, rub cream in her hands and feet. When I lean down to kiss her goodbye, I whisper, 'I love you.' Words that maybe have lost their meaning, being asked to stand for so many unspoken particulars. Language is what honors the vanishing. Or is language what slows the leaving? Or does it only deepen what we know of loss?" I think language does all three. It honors the vanishing, slows the leaving, and deepens what we know of loss. This poem speaks to me because I'm losing an old dear friend. I use the word old because our friendship spans the several decades since I was 16, and also because 3 weeks ago she celebrated her 99th birthday, the same day she learned her lymphoma is back. When I talk to her, I try to tell her some of the particulars behind my I love you, how she listened patiently and sympathetically to the woes about my own mother when I was a teen, never pointing out my part in the dramas, how she offered me the reassuring long-range view when I worried about the latest phase in my own daughter's growing up, how she'd absorb a litany of my work-life frustrations over the phone on a slow commute home. I'm so grateful for the opportunities to share these particulars with her. On Jeff's and my 8th wedding anniversary, I started the day with a mammogram because my doctor had found a lump a couple days before. The technician was rough. She started pawing me, trying to find it, and I felt like a piece of meat. "Well, didn't you feel it?" she said crossly, as though I needed guilt added to the fear. After 2 hours of x-rays and then an ultrasound, I was told I need to come back in a couple more days for a needle biopsy. I hurt. I felt beaten up. I didn't want anyone touching me. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I didn't even want to tell Jeff. There was nothing he could say to help, and no matter what he said, it would be wrong. He'd either be too matter-of-fact or too smothering. In this case, language would fail for sure. I called him right away to get it over with, and because I knew he was waiting to hear what had happened. He took the news quietly on the matter-of-fact side. I paced the house and tried my best to distract myself from useless worry. After a time, I heard the garage door go up and knew he was home a couple hours early. I bristled and braced myself. He stood quietly in front of me and said softly, "I've been distracted ever since you called and realized I was just staring at my computer screen a lot. I asked myself, what am I doing here when I just want to be with Pam? So I came home just to be near you." And then he took me in his arms slowly and gently and just held me. And I realized I'd been wrong. There was something he could say, and he'd just said it. So I pulled myself together and suggested, "Let's pack a picnic dinner with a bit of wine and go sit by some water somewhere." We drove to Vancouver Lake, only to find it had just been closed due to an E. coli outbreak. But the park attendant said, "Well, you can go on in if you promise not to go in the water." We had the whole lovely sandy beach and the entire lake to ourselves. We munched our sandwiches, sipped a bit of wine, watched the water and the birds and the sky, and simply basked in each other's presence. It was one of the most intimate, relaxing evenings I have ever spent. At Pentecost, the Holy Spirit descended and empowered people to speak in languages they did not know how to speak. Yet those who were attracted to that place heard their own native tongues and understood the message. Well, the Holy Spirit is still with us today. It dwells within each of us, and through it, we speak a universal language, the language of presence, the most powerful language of all. It needs no translation, no transliteration, no words even, yet it speaks eloquently. It's about showing up, about being there, about standing with and sitting next to, when words completely fail and are superfluous even. Who in your life needs you to be there today? Who do you need to show up for? Who do you need to stand with or sit next to? Don't worry about what you'll say. Your presence will speak volumes, and the Holy Spirit will see to it that your message of love is understood.